some have invited to go back to our breathing, so that our collective energy of mindfulness will bring us together as an organism, going as a river, with no more separation. Let the whole Sangha breathe as one body, generate peace as one body, and be free as one body. Let us transcend the boundaries of an illusive self, liberating from the superiority complex, the inferiority complex, and the equality complex.
So welcome everyone. And before we get into our formal teaching for tonight, we'll begin with an opportunity. If anyone has any questions about the practice, the formal practices that we do here, or the practices we do at home, or just any questions that I know people read about mindfulness, read about Buddhism, Buddha Dharma, and they have some questions about just what it's about, or most importantly, how you bring it into your life. So any questions? Yes.
Could you say something about depression?
About depression. Mm-hmm.
To kind of look into my perceptions and my mental formations to try to figure out why it's there.
Mm-hmm. Yes. That's not an easy subject. The question is, say something about depression. Let me just say, probably the field of psychology certainly has a lot to say about depression. Depression, again, you know, my background is as a mental health professional. And if there is any entity of psychological emotional distress that has been studied, it is depression. As well as within the repertoire of modern day mental health, I think there are a lot of very effective ways of looking at it and treating it, both from a therapeutic stance, psychotherapeutic stance, as well as if that's not accessible from a medical or medication point of view. So I certainly, if chronic depression is something that one struggles with, certainly there's a lot of wisdom about depression that can be gained from modern psychology. And it's relatively accessible. From a Buddhist psychological point of view, these types of emotional afflictions, such as depression, such as anxiety, fear, etc., at its root come from a strong sense of a self, a me, an I, In the case of anxiety, it's a fear or worry about what may happen to us or to others. From the point of view of depression, which is related to often to a sadness, it is around a loss, something the self has felt that it's lost. And that loss can extend to all kinds of things. I mean, we can lose a friend, we can lose our health, we can lose our youth, we can lose, you know, there's lots, we can lose our job, we can lose our identity, we can, you know, there's lots, we can lose our opportunities, there's lots of self can feel lost, like it's lost something. I think if you look deeply into depression, like you would look deeply into anxiety or fear or anger or resentment, one would always find at its basis perception. It is the way the eye is looking at its life, looking at its past, looking at its future, or looking at its current situations. Right? It is based on the way we are thinking about situations or ourselves or another. And again, often based on how we are thinking about our life, that often produces the emotional coloration, in this case of depression, which is often sadness. When one looks deeply into the nature of thought, one cannot help but see that intrinsically there is nothing solid there. Thoughts come and go. And not only do thoughts come and go, but the way we view things come and go. So, example, we might be in an emotional state that we might characterize by depression that is based on the way we are looking at our life, but we haven't always looked at our life that way. We may not have looked at our life that way yesterday, or we may not have looked at that life that way an hour ago or a month ago. And so there is nothing truthful in that momentary perception of the way we're looking at our life or the way we're looking at another human being. The impermanent nature of thoughts and the temporary nature of thoughts and how they arise without any often basis in reality is very important. What do I mean by a basis in reality? Which means I can think anything. I can sit here and think, I've had the most wonderful life in the world and I should just be grateful for everything that has ever happened to me, right? I've just had a wonderful life. I mean, I've just had the most marvelous, wonderful life. It just fills me with joy to know that. Right? Am I possible that I could say that? I could also say I've had the most terrible life. Right? I've had a life I wouldn't wish on anybody else. Just filled with misery. And I could say that, couldn't I? And I could say a million and one other things about my life, couldn't I? Depending on, in this moment, how I perceive it. The truth is what? The truth is whatever life I have lived for the last 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90 years is over, isn't it? Is over. And the story we tell ourselves about our life, which again changes, because even our memory is so selective. I mean, if you add up your age and if you add up all the minutes in it, seconds in it, or all the experiences in it, the numbers get quite large, right? Thousands, tens of thousands. And yet our memory may pick out, several key ones. So we will create a theme. Now again, the reason I'm saying this, David, is because, as I said earlier, in terms of the psychological there are very insightful things in the whole realm of cognitive therapy and behavioral therapy, which really helps us understand at that level, you know, what we're doing to create this psychological experience of depression. But so that's why I'm just kind of answered from a deeper, what I would say, Buddhist point of view, which is, once we understand that there is in any solid, permanent way a past other than a story that I continue, and that if the story I've written for myself or I tell myself is one that creates sadness or anger, it is because I am creating that story. It is gone. It is over. In the same way, anxiety and worry is always about the future, which we know has the same relationship to reality as the past. The past is just stories that we carry. It is gone. The future is simply stories we carry about what hasn't happened, what we think is going to happen. But that's not real, because it hasn't happened. Right? And so, to look deeply into the nature of thought, and to look deeply into the nature of the impermanence and unreliability and fickleness of thought, is certainly a freeing. And whether that is because we see that in relationship to the story that we've made up about our past, or else we see that in relationship to our actual meditative capacity to see clearly, like we do when we sit for 20 or 30 minutes, or 20 or 30 years, the truth is all the same. Thoughts endlessly come and go. They arise and disappear. And often, most often, there is no rhyme or reason to them. And the fact that we give them some kind of meaning, and the fact that we pick up and string them together like a person has his whole table full of beads and has their little string and picks up this one and picks up that one and picks up this one and picks up that one and strings it together to look a certain way. Right? It's just a kind of random chance kind of thing. Or it could be very deliberate. But either way, it forgets the thousands of other beads that have not been picked up. On the other side, there is someone who is telling a story. Right? So when we tell ourselves a depressing story about our life, whether it is a life of past mistakes and missed opportunities, or whether it's sort of a helplessness or a hopelessness about our situation at present, that story is being told by somebody. And that somebody who tells that story identifies that story as theirs. That's also which makes it seem kind of strong. But as you know, David, from your involvement in the intensive and the retreat, when one looks into the mind for that person, thing, entity, thinker who is creating those thoughts, he cannot be found. She cannot be found. So the sense of a permanent person, you know, I am depressed, right? When one looks deeply to find that I that is depressed, one cannot find that entity called who is depressed. And even when one looks for some solid, permanent thing called depression, one cannot find that. What can one find? Feelings and thoughts. Right? All one can find are feelings and thoughts. One cannot find a self or an I who owns that thought, nor can one find such a permanent entity that's always there called depression or anxiety. One finds feelings, thoughts, and sensations. And when one watches them, one sees they just come and go. They have no permanent solidity to them. Now that's very insightful. Right? That's very insightful. Because if I hear a voice commanding me to do something, or if I hear a voice that's telling me something about reality, right? I certainly want to know whose voice that is. And whether that voice really speaks with authority, especially if it's telling me something that is creating a deep emotional disturbance in me. And yet, we hear this voice in our head, and this voice may be telling us, in the case of emotional afflictions, they'd be telling us hurtful things, sad things about life, about others. But when we look for the source of this voice, we can't find it. It's a voice appearing in our head, and we cannot find where it's coming from. We can't find where it's arising from, and after it's passed, we cannot find where it's gone. Now, something like that I would consider fairly insubstantial. Right? And I certainly, if I was going to run my life on a voice, I would certainly want that to be an authoritative voice. Right? And a voice that speaks with consistency. And especially, I think, if one is running one's own life, as hopefully we are doing, I would want to listen to a voice that really has my best interests at heart. And from the 30 years that I was a psychotherapist, that I was involved with people who are depressed, if there's anything consistently I found out, was the voice of depression is not a very caring voice. It's not a very loving voice. It's not a voice that steers you toward well-being. Right? It's a voice that always steers you toward toward more sadness, to more lethargy, to more aloneness, right? To more disconnection, to more helplessness. You know what I'm saying? I mean, that's not a voice to listen to, right? I mean, if you're a little down, you're not going to call up your most depressed friend to get you out of it? What? And you're like, no. Right? But yet, I mean, it's always interesting to me, and I mean, again, there are reasons for this, but that when people get depressed, they isolate more, right? And they isolate more, so they're more alone with what? This depressing voice inside them. Right? And the more they isolate, the more that's what they hear. And it's just a snowball that's going in the wrong direction. When you are depressed, or moving into being depressed, that is not a voice you want to listen to. Because it's not giving you good advice. Right? But it tells you what? It tells you things are hopeless, things that you can't do anything about it. It's only going to get worse. Nothing I do is going to make any difference. Right? Again. In the practice of mindfulness, we turn our awareness onto what is occurring in reality. Right? And whether it's the reality of sitting or walking or breathing or eating looking at the cars going up and down the road, whatever it is. But it's also the mindfulness of thoughts and feelings. It's also the practice of mindfulness, to be present. And so we want to be able to really observe the arousal of thoughts and feelings in our mind. And when we see that there are certain types of feelings, whether they are sadness or fear or anger or resentment or jealousy, etc., that seem to have a kind of a constant or a dwelling place within our consciousness, and we want to be very attentive to that. Why? Because there's a part of us that's not healthy in this moment, is it? There's a part of us that's sick. Right? And in the same way, our physical bodies can get sick, right? Now, how do we know our physical bodies get sick? Because we don't feel good, right? Our bodies don't feel good, right? The usual way they feel, the usual energy they have, whatever, is not there, and oftentimes we are experiencing discomfort. We're experiencing pain in our body. So we know we are sick. Well, our minds get sick. And here, when I say sick, I don't mean the kind of sickness, to lead us into psychiatric care. We accept a certain kind of sickness of the mind, unfortunately, as normal. Right? We have much greater awareness when our body gets sick than we do when our mind gets sick, because I think we somehow have a better idea of what it means to be healthy. Right? So when we get the flu, or we get some pain in us, or we get something, we're more readily aware that we are physically sick. But our mind will carry these sicknesses. What are these sicknesses? The sicknesses of out of control sadness, hurt, grief, depression. The sickness of fear and anxiety and worry. The sickness of chronic anger and resentment and rage and frustration, right? The sickness of dissatisfaction. We'll carry these things and we'll think it's normal. Because we don't have that same sense of well-being, of mind, right? That we really kind of do probably more for our bodies. So when, I would say, when we are suffering from emotional afflictions, our minds are sick. They're not well, right? They're not functioning at a level of their capacity for well-being. And so we should be very caring. We should take good care of our minds. In the same way, if we have a part of our body is sick or not well, the whole body takes care of it. We stop and we rest. You know, I may just have a sore throat, I may have a headache, I may have a head cold, I may have to rest, but the whole body will rest. I can't take off my head and, just leave that home. Right? Or in the same way, if I have a physical part of me that is hurting, the whole part of me will take care of that part. We won't continue to injure it. So in the same way, oftentimes there's a part of us, an emotional part of us, a mental part of us, that's not well. Right? It's suffering. It's suffering from depression, it's suffering from sadness, it's suffering from fear, it's suffering from anger, resentment, it's suffering from loss, it's suffering from loneliness. Right? And so, in those times, we need to be mindful that kind of suffering is in me. Right? And we have to be very clear that we are not going to continue to do things that increase the illness of our mind. But even better yet, we want to do things, right? To take care of it. I mean, if I have a stomachache, right? If I have a lot of pain in my stomach, am I going to keep eating? Just keep shoveling it down? No, we would stop eating, wouldn't we? I mean, hopefully. If our stomach hurts. Why? Because we know there's a part of us that is hurting, and to continue to do something that harms it is only going to make it worse. Right? Part of our body is hurting, if our leg is hurting, because we've strained it, we're not going to keep walking to make it worse. Right? We're going to rest. We're going to take care of our body. We need to take care of our minds, our emotions. So when we suffer from anxiety, when we suffer from depression, something's not right. Something about the way we're living is not right. because our minds have become sick, have become ill. And so we need to stop and take care of our minds, right? So we can be at ease, and so we can be happy. Happy not tra-la-la, happy not silly goofy, happy but like just an inner kind of well-being. Happy. These mind states, which we call depression or anxiety or anger, are not solid. They've not always been there and they will not always be there, and they come and they go. Now that's very meaningful. Because often when they are there, they feel very permanent, solid, and real. But that's a misperception. Upon investigation, nothing solid called depression can be found. We can find sensations, we can find feelings, and we can find some thoughts. But that's about it. But if we don't look carefully and stop and investigate, the appearance of solidity can be overwhelming, right? When we look up in the summer when the storm clouds, they appear solid, don't they? But they're not solid, right? We can look up on a cloudy day and the sky can look overcast and it appears solid to us, but we know if we get in a plane, we can go right through there, can't we? It appears solid, but there's nothing really of any solidity there. Thoughts are like that and emotions are like that. But to experience that, it takes some capacity and willingness to be present, to be mindful. Which means to have the mind fully present to that experience and the willingness to investigate, to look deeply. What is this? This thought, this feeling that I'm having. Any other questions? Yes.
I was just wondering, the fact that our human condition to reform the third part of the understanding is not within and outside. I think people don't get one day, therefore they're not happy for the human at the end.
So you mean other?
I think isn't it sort of the natural? Isn't it part of human, our condition as humans to be like this?
To be like what?
To be with other species of not, and that we have to get aware of our programming.
So the question is that doesn't this seem to be the usual pattern of human life to be saying, of course, that's why we're here. That's right? Well, we're here because of all that. But again, this is the difference between, again, you know, like physically. I mean, one can have all kinds of, you know, we inherit all kinds of things. We may inherit we inherit a certain kind of body from our ancestors, from our parents, and that body may have all kind of vulnerabilities or proclivities based on our genetic pool. But again, how we take care of that body, right, has a lot to do with whether those physical vulnerabilities in our body begin to dominate, or whether they don't, whether they become, you know, there but very benign. Right? A lot of it has to do with the way we act, right, with our body. Same way with our mind. Yeah, we may have all kinds of proclivities that we've inherited from our families. Right? And the same way we inherit a physical body, and many of us also inherit an emotional body, whether that is genetic or whether that is environmental, you know, we'll let the academics argue about. Yeah, but either way, it's true. I mean, that we are conditioned. Right? But that has always been the truth. The Buddha himself was conditioned. He was conditioned what? To be an upper class playboy, you could say. That was what he was conditioned to. Huh? That's what he was being raised to be. But we know that he overcame his conditioning, didn't he? Why? Because he had a capacity to look more deeply into his own condition and the human condition. And he saw some things that make being an upper-class playboy, less than a source of forever happiness. So he made a turn, right, to look for a kind of happiness or well-being that wasn't based on, having lots of money and good looks. Fairly superficial. Yes. Why do we undertake a spiritual path, a meditative path? Because we understand that even though we have been conditioned by our genetic tree, our family tree, our parents, our schools, our society, etc., 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 right? We have the capacity to regain our freedom through conscious living. At that point, our excuses become more difficult. Right? That's the problem. When we didn't know that, we could just continue down the path of ignorance. Right? But once we have encountered a kind of teachings and practices which reveal to us the source of our dissatisfaction, the source of our discomfort, the source of our unhappinesses in life, the source of our emotional afflictions, and at the same time reveals to us another way of living, right, that is productive of happiness and well-being, then it's in our hands. It doesn't mean that we still don't have our conditioning, our karma, our habit force kind of continuing to get our attention. But the path and the teachings will tell us how to deal with it. And then it really becomes a matter of what? How much we trust the teachings, and then how much we're willing to practice. And that often has a relationship into how much one believes that one's suffering is not God-given, or that is not the fate. Some people misuse the word karma as if it's some kind of fate. It's not like that. It's causes and conditions that arise according to causes and conditions. And when causes and conditions change, causes and conditions change. So we have the capacity to change. necessarily capacity to change. And we know in the time of the Buddha, the serial murderers came to him. Just as an extreme. I mean, all sorts of people came to him. The serial killers came to him. And became his disciples. And we know that through practice and transformation, they came to various kinds of realizations of this freedom from the murderous path they had been on. Now, I would imagine in this room there aren't too many serial killers or people who are carrying that kind of heavy karma with them. Oh, but you know, we saw several months ago, you know, we showed that DVD Dharma Brothers. Many of you were here. Saw the Dharma Brothers, you know, about, you know, just a group of guys. All of them, I believe, were incarcerated for murder, capital crimes. All of them in a maximum security prison in Alabama, you know. And entered into a process of insight meditation practice. And we heard from them. They were capable of insights and understanding into themselves, into their own capacity for creating suffering in their life. And we saw that they were capable of transformation. So, and those guys were the hardcore. Most of us, we're on the outside. we're not the hardcore. So we have the capacity for change. Any other questions? So good. What I want to talk to you tonight, you know, the it's an interesting world lately, right? I mean, it's always an interesting world. But, you know, Japan, great suffering. Middle East, great suffering. And transformation going on. And even though our obvious response is to the immediacy of the suffering of the people, and the desire to be of some help. I think we also need to see what is going on as a kind of a basic teaching on impermanence that has to have deep meaning to us. You know, impermanence, anicca, impermanence was like this one of the fundamental of teachings of the Buddha, that everything is subject to change. Everything is impermanent, not permanent. And you know at your chanting service, you chant the five remembrances. I know retreat you chant. I am the nature to what? I'm the nature to grow, to have ill health. There's no way, nothing that can prevent me from having ill health. I'm of the nature to grow old. There is nothing I can do to prevent myself from growing old. I am the nature to die. There is nothing I can do to prevent death. Everyone I love and everything I cherish is of the subject of impermanence, and I will lose them, or they will lose me. And the last thing is, all I have is the only thing I can stand on is my own actions of body, speech, and mind. This is very profound. You know, it can be understood very easily intellectually. Oh, everything changes, everything's impermanent. But if we, this has to be contemplated. Because there's great liberation. There's a reason the Buddha put it first, you know. Everything's impermanent. Well, he's trying to wake us up. Right? You know those poor people in Japan? They had homes. They had families. And they had lives. Right? they were probably before the tsunami or the earthquake struck. And they probably all had plans for the day, didn't they? They probably all had plans for the week, for the month. They probably all had plans for their life and how it was going to unfold. Just like us. No different than us. And yet in a moment, swept away. In that moment, what was revealed with frightening immediacy and power, impermanence. And even though that was dramatic, right, and made headlines, that the fires of impermanence burn everywhere. And that needs to be remembered. Because even though the impermanence of the natural world, again, you know, we live with such a sense of control and that we can do whatever we want. And we can put our homes wherever we want and we can live wherever we want. And we can plan for whatever we want, right? And yet, natural disasters, whether it's a tsunami or an earthquake or a Katrina, show us what? It's nonsense, isn't it? But in the same way for each of us, sickness shows us our ideal of always being healthy. Is a false perception. Aging. And we are aging, all aging. I mean, you know, the younger people here are aging too. You know, it's sort of a up and then it kind of goes that way. But we're all in the process of changing. We're all aging. And the young children here will one day look like us. Even though it's hard to believe. And we at one point used to look like them. And that's just the way it is. That's just the truth. Right? Death. Our own death. The death of everyone we love. The death of everyone we've known. The death of everyone we've ever known. Is also a reality that in no way can be stopped or denied. And again, the fact that our relationship to each other, our relationship to objects, and objects, you know, can be anything, is all temporary and can be stripped away at any moment. And that is not, that may be something that is frightening, scary, or unsettling, but if looked at, is very liberating. And this is, I think, why the Buddha taught us, and I think this is why it's such a fundamental thing that we have to reflect on, because to make sure we get it, not just intellectually, but that we know it. Because if we don't know it, we are always what? Grasping. We're always holding on. We don't think we are, but we are. And we, because of the nature of the way the ego and the self and the senses, we won't go into the whole process, grasp at things, we set ourselves up for suffering. So the capacity to see everything as impermanent, temporary, unfixed, prevents us from grasping at things as if they're permanent and solid and can give us something. And what is that something we want from objects? When I call objects, I mean people we're objects to. Relationships are objects. Jobs are objects. Attainments are objects. Mental objects. Physical objects. Things. It's a thing. When we try to grasp something to hold on to it, as it begins to move through its temporariness and it begins to change or disappear or shift. And if we are grasping at it because we want it to stay the same, always the same, same body, same health, same people in my life, same objects, same relationship, same type of relationship, you know, et cetera, et cetera. If we want things to be fixed and solid and permanent, the naturalness of impermanence will cause us suffering. Right? It is that capacity to have a deep understanding of impermanence that frees us from that attaching, that grasping, that holding on to, and allows us what? To live at peace with how things are. And to know, as it said in the last verse, at the end of the day, all I have is what? You know? We saw that, right? It was interesting. You know, people are commenting now on a lot of the Japanese survivors. You know, just their mental attitude, you know, right? People are commenting, you know, there's no looting. when rescuers are coming to rescue people, the people who are being rescued are saying, you know, forgive me for causing being such a nuisance. They're interesting, right? You know, people are being understanding, people are being accepting. They don't because when everything is stripped away, what are you left with? You're left with who you are. What kind of person we are. Right? Because at the end of the day, that's what matters. Take all my things away. What kind of person am I? Right? If our goodness is real, right, then it's real. When everything is stripped away. But when things start falling away and we get scared and angry and sad and hurt and disturbed and blamed, you know, that reveals what? Where we are. That's why that verse, you know, all I have, all I can stand of, are the actions of my body, speech, and mind. I mean, that's our nakedness, my friends. Right? And impermanence. And impermanence is going on all the time because things are changing in our lives all the time. Right? Things are not working out the way we thought they would. People are not acting the way we want them to. It goes on and on, right? That's all impermanence. Things aren't fixed. How do we deal with it? So again, you know, when we see these calamities, when we read the paper every day, right, please see impermanence. things are not the way I thought they were. Everything is what? Causes and conditions, causes and conditions, endless variables. What's going on in the Middle East? Causes and conditions. Oh, but I didn't think it was going to happen that way. Because we don't look deeply. If you look deeply into the society, you see the conditions that were there, the causes that were there, that could create, just like that, a change. But if we see things as stable and solid, then we're always shocked. And we're always taken by surprise. We say things, I can't believe what's going on. Can you believe what's going on in the world? Right? People, right? Well, how can you not believe it? It's happening. I mean, it's just the truth. And why is it happening? Because of causes and conditions. Yeah, we might have missed a bunch of them. Just because we were living in our thoughts about reality and not really present to the reality as it was unfolding. So again, please look deeply into the unfolding of life. Not just our own life, where impermanence is unfolding right before our eyes all the time, but in the life of the world, and then in these big things. We seem to be happening with greater frequency because of causes and conditions. If you can accept deeply the reality of impermanence, you can live freely in the world. Able to respond to situations in the most skillful and helpful way, and not be thrown with emotional affliction, of fear, of sadness, of being getting distraught, of overwhelming grief. Again, the Buddha taught impermanence so people would not be grasping after things that cannot give them what they want. We want to be happy. And we want to be safe, feel secure. We want to live a meaningful life. But that has to come from within us, in the way we live, in the way we think, in the way we act. Cannot come from collecting things to give us a sense of solidness and permanence. Again, you know, this should not move you into indifference. Let me just conclude. You know, if there are people you love, you can love them. But please understand that they will not always be here. Actually, we do not know, right? Parents, we don't know how long our children are going to be here. Children, we don't, if we're all children, we don't know how long our parents are going to be here. We don't know how long our friends are going to be here. And we don't know how long they're going to continue to be in the way they are now. Do we? So look at them, and when you go home, see them that way. That everybody you relate to is subject to sickness, old age, and death, and impermanence, and that's just the way it is. And all you know is what? In this moment, they are here the way they are. And you can love them like that. You can love without grasping, without holding on. Because you can't hold on. Right? Impermanence is a fact of life. We can't stop it. I know when I used to work with families, you know, parents often get very freaked out because they couldn't control that, you know, their children get older and became teenagers. They couldn't control them anymore. Very scary. You know, many parents, they wanted to hold them, right? Lock them up somewhere. monitor all their phone calls and all their friends and social relations, because, right? Yeah, I mean, because, and yet what? If we do that to our children, then they'll never develop their own capacity, said my father. Better to give our children, the skills to deal with life as it is, rather than trying to control them and wall them off from us. Right? So again, it doesn't mean we don't love. It doesn't mean we don't have relationships. It doesn't mean we don't have jobs. It doesn't mean we don't have houses. It doesn't mean, right? It doesn't mean we don't have bodies. It just means we understand. When we look at them, we know they are of the nature of impermanence. Is that clear? So it's a teaching the Buddha taught to liberate us. Please understand that, to liberate us. So we don't grasp and hold on to things that can't be grasped or held on to. And so we'll stop here. Thank you.